Hello. You're very welcome to the Alison Spittle Show with me, Alison Spittle. It is very warm where I am right now. I'm in the height of summer and I'm keeping the door closed because I'm doing this podcast intro. This podcast's guest is Rosemary McCabe. Rosemary McCabe is a writer from Ireland. I've been following Rosemary McCabe's work for a long time and I'm just very interested in the way she works. She's been doing Patreon a couple of years now and doing her own content. And she's also putting together a book. And also, she's bringing out a podcast. Well, it's out now. It's called Not Without My Sister, with her sister Beatrice. And you should have a listen to it where you can get podcasts. And have a listen to the chat that me and Rosemary McCabe are having now. This is the
Is that an umbrella? What's that behind you?
That guy there behind me is the Wheel of Misfortune. So me and Fern Brady are launching a new podcast and we do this thing where each week we pick a subject by spinning the wheel. So I made a wheel and it spins.
Oh, cute.
Yeah, it's cool. It's got like little subjects on it and stuff. And I love it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So it's exciting. Talking about launching new podcasts, you're in the same boat yourself.
Yeah.
So talk to me about It's Not Without My Sister. That's what it's called, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Based on the film Not Without My Daughter, with which our mom is obsessed. We were trying to come up with names like for our podcast and we were looking up like, you know, sister, just kind of stupid. And then we were, because my name is Rosemary and my sister's name is Beatrice, we were looking up stuff with R&B. But then it was kind of misleading because it's not actually about R&B, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I would be mad.
Yeah. Although, like, maybe we would then get loads of listeners in the first 30 seconds and then just like huge bounce rate.
That's all you need.
But well, that's true. But we basically set up a podcast because I'm living in America now, and she's been here for the last 10 years, and I moved in with her for a couple of months, and it was the first time that we'd been together physically in probably 15, 20 years. And we just started having all these chats that we thought were hilarious and really interesting. So we thought, why don't we make them into a podcast and record them, basically.
So where do you fall in your family siblings? Like, how many siblings do you have? Where are you? Where's Beatrice?
We just have each other. So there's just two of us. Oh. And she is 6 and a half, very important, 6 and a half years older than me.
Yeah, that's, so I'm the eldest in my family. I'm six years older than my sister, the second oldest one. There is like a big difference because you feel like an only child for the first six. I consider myself an only child for the first few years of my life, you know, and treated like that. And then the resources deplete. And I won't lie, I did feel some animosity towards my sister.
I mean, I'd say it's a big adjustment for kids. Like, do you mean, because you've had your parents to yourself and your house to yourself and your toys to yourself for 6 years, and then all of a sudden you're expected to share and not have an issue with it.
Exactly. Who is this lad? Like, what's going on here? What was it like to be the younger sister?
I just always wanted to hang out with her and her friends, and I wasn't allowed. You know what I mean? So I was the really annoying little sister, so I wasn't allowed to hang out with her and her friends, and then I would tell on her and be like, Beatrice is being mean to me, Beatrice isn't letting me do this, she's not letting me do that. So I think I was probably a pain in the ass. But like, we didn't really become friends until probably I was like 17 or 18. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, until we were both almost adults together. Because we were children together for a very limited period, and then she was a teenager and I was a child, and then she was an adult and I was a teenager. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it wasn't until we were both in the same kind of phase that we started actually to get on and understand each other. And I think I probably had a lot of resentment as well from years of wanting to hang out with her and being too young. You know, being too young to come trick-or-treating with her and her and our older cousins, or being too young to go here with her, to go there with her, to play with her friends. And I was probably really raging about it for years.
I kind of like look at younger siblings and younger relatives now as like a almost like a marking of time. Do you know? Like if they're like an adult now, I'm like, oh Christ, how old am I?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. And like when they get phones, I feel that's a big marker. Or just some of the questions, like when young people ask questions, I was trying to explain to my nephew who's 9 about the fact that there was a world before the internet.
Yeah.
And he just does not, like, this is just not going into his head at all. It's not something he understands. Like, what? Sure, like, what? What would you do? You know, what?
How, why did your sister move to America?
My sister is a fashion designer, and she first moved to Italy when she graduated and worked in Milan for a couple of years. And then she went to Paris, and then she ended up getting, I think, recruited to work for Diane von Furstenberg in New York. And then she moved somewhere else and went to Dallas. And now she's in Indiana working for a US accessories company called Vera Bradley. So she kind of, like, she jokes about it that she did her career backwards. Like, she started in high fashion. She worked in Marni, and then she worked for John Galliano, who was at Dior at the time.
Whoa.
And now she's ended up kind of in the more kind of family business in the American Midwest.
What kind of accessories are they? I'm interested now, because this sounds cool. Like a small town.
So they do... well, no, it's like, I think it's the number 3 accessories firm in America. So it's big.
Okay.
and they do luggage. They do backpacks. They do tote bags. They're really... It's one of those weird things. Like, Vera Bradley as a company is only in America, so they don't ship to Europe. Mm. But once you're in America and you notice them, you notice everybody has them. Do you know what I mean? It's almost kind of like the, like, you know, for a period in Dundrum, you'd see so many Orla Kiley bags.
Yes, yeah.
Vera Bradley is kind of like the Orla Kiley, but it's all over America. And like, I've started seeing it as well a lot in, I was watching that, you know, Jessica Jones on Netflix.
Yes. Yeah.
I was watching the latest series of that, and in the first episode, one of the women in the show has a Vera Bradley bag. So it's just one of those brands. It's like everywhere.
And what kind of what made you move to America, actually?
So I, like, my sister had always been trying to get me to move, not just to America, but to come, you know, come to Paris for a year, come to Milan for a year, and I've always been a real homebody. Mm-hmm. And I never really wanted to go anywhere. And I think it was only as I got a little bit older, I'm 35 now. So as I got into my 30s and I realized, okay, like, my friends are at different stages to me now. Like, a lot of my friends are married. Like, a lot of my friends have kids. And I was getting more and more kind of restless, going, I don't really know what I'm in Dublin kind of waiting around to happen. And I had been in a relationship for 5 years, and then that ended the year before last. So for the first time in ages, I was single. Didn't have a mortgage, didn't have any kids. And my sister said, look, why don't you see if you can get a visa and just come over, even come over for a year, come over for 2 years, see what it's like. And I had realized as well in the last couple of years that I wanted to have kids, which was something that I never thought I did want to have kids. And I kind of only realized once I was like single and without the means to make them, which was handy. And I was like, oh, great. But I realized that, like, she has 4 kids, right? She has 4 kids ranging from age 9 to age 2. And I was like, God, like, if I don't have kids on my own, this is as close as I'll get to kind of being involved in these kids' lives, but I'm halfway across the world.
Yeah.
So I kind of thought, well, why don't I go and, like, give it a year or 2 years and see what it's like over there and, you know, get to be a part of their lives. And I mean, it wasn't that easy, because it's not like you just decide to go to America and you go tomorrow. Like, it was a long, drawn out, expensive visa process. But that was kind of how it all started.
And kind of, how did you feel? What was your kind of attitude towards having kids before you realized? Because I don't want to have kids, and I'm now afraid that this realization will come upon me. So, talk me through that a bit so I can look out for the signs.
I never particularly wanted to have kids in the way that, you know, some people are like, oh, I always knew I wanted to have kids, right? I was kind of the opposite, that I was like, I never thought that I wanted to have kids. Like, it never really occurred to me to go, oh, I'd love a baby. And then just like a variety of things happened. I think I turned 30, and maybe there's some kind of biological clock somewhere. But I think a part of it is to do with, I went and got fertility testing for an article, actually, a couple of years ago. And I was so, like, I was not invested in this at all, because I was really like, I don't want to have kids. And then when I had the fertility testing, I was told that I have a really low egg count. So for whatever reason, well, there are two possible reasons for having a low egg count. One could be that you're just born with a low egg count, and one could be that your eggs are dying off quicker than they should or than the average person. But I had the test done the following year again, and it turns out they're not dying off any quicker, but I just had a lower number of eggs, which could mean that it could be hard to have children, but could also mean, you know, you only need one good egg. So
that's
who knows?
True. But that's like Lady Gaga.
Yeah.
You only need one guy in the room to be, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But that kind of made me go, oh God, like this thing that I always assumed was going to be in my control now maybe isn't actually going to be up to me. And it made me think about it in more of a kind of a practical way. And then like, this sounds really stupid and like airy-fairy, but I had this dream a couple of years ago that I had a baby, and in my dream I was breastfeeding the baby. Mm-hmm. And I was just so happy and like so... I have this, like, I mean, I'm sure anyone who's ever breastfed is like, it's not like this, but I have this fantasy of like breastfeeding being really cozy and just getting to sit on the couch for weeks and like have snacks brought to you and shit, because you're like, I'm feeding a baby.
Yeah, you're basically a big gallon of milk that needs to be.
Yeah. And I'm like, I'm busy nurturing, so like people have to mind you. But I had this dream, and when I woke up and realized that this wasn't a real baby and I didn't have a baby, I felt really bereft. And I think it was at that point that I really started to think, oh, maybe I do want a baby. And then I also, you know what, this sounds kind of hideously practical, but I don't have any big hobbies. I don't love traveling.
Yeah.
I don't have any big dreams that I'm like, oh, you know, I don't really want to have kids because they don't fit into my idea of my life doing X. Like, I don't particularly like going to gigs. There's a lot of standing, a lot of queuing. I hate that. I like watching live music on the television. I like watching Glastonbury from the comfort of my sofa. So there's nothing that I was like, kids are going to get in the way of this. And by that same token, I went, well, if I don't have kids, what do you do for the rest of your life? Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, do I just live with myself and my dog and my, you know, partner if I have one? And what do we do if I'm not particularly, like, I like seeing nice places in the world, but I more like to go on holidays. Like, I don't really like traveling, but I'd like to go for a nice, you know, 5-star 2-week holiday.
Yeah.
So it was just like all those different things kind of made me go, maybe it would actually be nice to have a family.
And
in that sense,
was it at that point then that you kind of like made the effort to get more in touch with that side of the family in America?
I don't know necessarily that I was that strategic about it, if that makes sense. Like when I came over to visit last May. And I hadn't seen my sister or her kids in over a year, I think, because, I mean, it's obviously expensive. Like, it's 2 flights to get to where we are now, which is Fort Wayne in Indiana. It's expensive. I had been kind of like fluttering around, as they say, between jobs. And I hadn't really been anywhere long enough to take a 2-week holiday, if you know what I mean. Like, I'd been doing one job and then I hadn't really liked it. So I'd gone and done something else. And then I'd been freelance. So when I was freelance, I'd been like a bit poor. And then when I was working, I didn't have enough holidays. So however it happened, I just hadn't been over.
Yeah.
And I hadn't met Fox, who was like one and a bit at that point. So it was only when I came over last year, and I came over for 3 weeks, that Bea and Don, her husband, kind of started going, well, would you consider staying? And like, also, I think it was the first time in a couple of years that I was fully freelance and not freelancing for TV3 or not freelancing for somewhere where I'd have to be in Dublin.
Yeah, yeah.
If you know what
I
mean? Like, I was totally, like, I could literally have worked from anywhere. So it was the first time I think that it actually made sense, and probably the first time that I couldn't come up with a good reason to say, no, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. That feels like life had made that kind of comfortable for you to do. It's strange how life does that kind of.
Yeah, weird. And I mean, I would never have imagined that I would have ended up here. I mean, not that I've ended up, you know what I mean? But like, I would never have thought that would have happened. If you told me the year before, oh, you're going to end up moving to Indiana next year, I would have been like, no way.
Yeah. No,
absolutely not.
I suppose I wanted to kind of talk about your Patreon. Like, that is how you're making your living now predominantly. Or I don't know, actually. That's very presumptuous
yeah.
of me to say.
No, you can absolutely presume away. Yeah, that's true.
So what was it like making the first steps to kind of making a Patreon? I want to kind of talk about like the first time. Because you started a Patreon before the lockdown. Like, loads of people have Patreons now.
Oh, I started Patreon in 2018, in at the start of 2018. So I had a podcast called How to Be Sound, which I still have, but it's very sporadic now because I'm very disorganized.
Preaching to the choir here.
I had a podcast. Yeah. And I had, you know, like I listened to a lot of podcasts. So I was aware that other podcasts had Patreon accounts. And I had my podcast and I thought, you know what, I'm going to set one up so that if people want to throw me a euro a month or throw me €4 a month or whatever, they can do that to say thanks for making the podcast that they enjoy. So that's why I set it up initially. And then I just started, I started uploading kind of special like mini episodes, like bonus content from my podcast onto my Patreon. And then I started uploading, oh yeah, I was doing on my own blog, I was doing money diaries every week where I detailed everything that I bought the week before. I was doing that on my own site. And it was getting really popular and I was getting like 2,000 readers on the day that it published, which is like kind of big in blog terms. And I thought to myself, why don't I put that on Patreon and see if people will give me like a dollar a month to read those? Because people were always going on about how much they enjoy them. I think it's like a very human, voyeuristic kind of, we love to know what other people are spending. And also Irish people are funny about money. So I think once people are honest, like everybody wants to know.
Yeah.
So I put that behind the kind of paywall on Patreon. And then from there, I just started adding more stuff. So I kind of went, you know what, I'm going to add another level where you get an extra piece of writing a week. And I'm going to add another level where you'll get, like, I'll write you a short story. And I'm going to add another level where I'll send you out something in the post every month. So that's kind of how it happened. And then by mid, or maybe the start of 2019, so about like maybe like a year and a half in, I was kind of at the point where I was earning maybe 28 grand a year before tax from Patreon.
That's incredible. Like,
yeah. Which is incredible. Which is like a low wage, right? Yeah. But is obviously incredible from Patreon. But I kind of decided, okay, I'm going to try and make this my full-time job now and just do this and concentrate on this. So from there I went to, like, now I write 4 pieces a week for Patreon. I have the short story level. I have the post level. I did like exclusive enamel pins. That was a different tier, like a different gift. So I do a few different things. So that's kind of how it's grown. Although in the last, like, 2019 was an amazing year for me on Patreon. 2020 has been really difficult.
And how's it? Okay, so is it the lockdown that kind of changed with Patreon, or what happened there?
I mean, yes. Like, I think it's definitely 90% COVID. I think a lot of people have been laid off. A lot of people have had their wages cut. A lot of people have seen just like tightening the kind of, you know, purse strings. And I think when you're cutting down and everything else, you know, this random person you pay to read their work or you support on Patreon, that can totally go. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's not a necessary expense.
Yeah.
So I do think a lot of it is to do with COVID. But I also, you know, like, I think it would be kind of egotistical not to acknowledge that I'm sure some people who've been reading kind of personal essays and opinion pieces and money diaries for a year or a year and a half, you kind of go, okay, you know what, I'm over that now. So I'm sure there is a certain level of people going, I'm a bit bored, I'm going to subscribe to someone else's Patreon, or I'm going to go and pay for something else, you know what I mean, and try something else for a while. And that totally makes sense to me as well.
Yeah, that's well, that is the kind of not to say scary thing, but there is. So when I do stand-up comedy and I'll do stuff about personal stuff, or sometimes, or even during lockdown, I can't remember what it was, but I tweeted something semi-emotional, and then I found I was getting like a lot more money on my coffee account, and then I felt weird for saying it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you kind of have that grapple all the time with your relationship with money and your relationship with being rewarded for being honest. I remember I was doing an Instagram live and I said something slightly very honest about doing comedy, about being jealous of other people in comedy. And I could see the little hearts go like that. And I'd never seen that before. Yeah. And I was like, shit, I better not, like, it's a very kind of strange relationship I have myself with honesty and being paid.
I think it's really easy. Like, it would be a really easy trap to fall into, to go, you know what, people really responded to that. Like, I know, for example, if I tweet, like, especially in the early days of Patreon, if I ever did a thread about how I had set up a Patreon and it had allowed me the freedom to write what I wanted, and it had meant that I didn't have to do kind of shock jock type opinion pieces for the Indo anymore, and I didn't have to go on TV3 and do the fashion police, which I kind of hated towards the end. Basically, once I explained to people the human
yes
benefits, or like, kind of, I'm trying to think of like the human cost to me, that like what it did to me to not have Patreon versus what it did to have it. Mm-hmm. Once I made that very clear, I would notice that my patrons would go up. Similarly, if I talk about my mental health on Instagram, actually more if I'm talking about it going, I'm having a really shit time, I'll get really, really positive engagement from that, versus if I say, oh, I'm doing really well with my mental health at the moment, this is what's helping me, that won't do as well.
Yeah.
And it can be so tempting to use that, because you're like, well, I know that that's going to give me a boost either in followers or in engagement or in supporters. And then you feel really dirty.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That you're like, well, like, I don't want to exploit my own suffering, or like, I don't want to basically turn into some kind of grief porn.
That is the scary thing, you know. Especially during lockdown, I've been finding that of like, because my main source of income is gone, so you're kind of, and I'm so thankful, like, you know yourself, when you see the Patreon go up, or you see who they are, or whatever, and sometimes they leave mm-hmm. little messages and stuff, and you're like, this is above and beyond, like,
yeah,
thank
yeah.
you so much.
Do you ever find that you get, because by that same token, right, obviously it's really meaningful and really gratifying and like really touching when people reach out and they support you, especially financially, because you know that that's harder than just going like, I'm going to like that picture. You know what I mean? That's actually putting your hand in your pocket. But by that same token, sometimes when people unsubscribe, I have to remind myself that that's not personal, which is really hard, because when they do subscribe, I kind of think that is personal. I'm like, that's because they love me.
Yes.
So then when they unsubscribe, I have to go, that's not because they hate you.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Oh, totally. Like, well, I know I supported you on Patreon for a while, and then my account went to zero. And then when I tried to take out more money, it was like, you can't pay this. And I was like, okay, fair enough. And it just, I just always put it on the long finger of like, I must do that again, because I have the money now.
Yeah.
I'll do it now today. But I just want you to know that wasn't personal. Do you know that was?
Oh,
like,
no.
I know you're not saying and that, I mean, but it's cool that I can see you in the face and I can tell you that.
Yeah.
It's you know.
Well, I think I supported you on Patreon for a while as well, and then I unsubscribed from almost everyone when COVID started happening, and when I noticed my income going way down, I went, okay, I'm going to cut down. Like, and you know, I unsubscribed from like Spotify and Netflix, and I tried to cut down everything.
Yeah.
And then every now and again, I'll like add one thing, and then I'll take it off at the end of the month and add something else and try to kind of share it around. But like, I completely know that it's not personal. But then sometimes when I see people I know relatively well, and like my little stupid head is going, I know they have money.
Yeah.
It's not like, it's literally not a personal thing what they choose to spend their money on. And they may just be going, doing what I'm doing, which is like, this month I'm going to give it here, and this month I'm going to give it here, and this month I'm going to like do this person's buy me a coffee, and next month, you know what I mean?
Totally.
Like, it's totally.
It's so weird.
But it's just hard to get that out of your head. Like,
it's so hard. Or even if it's like a really close friend that's bought me a coffee, I'm like, you don't have to do that. Do you know? Or I know that they're in the same industry as me, and I know like how, yeah, it's lovely, but it's such a weird mind fuck that I think we're going to have to get used to for the next while, because I think the old way of making a living is going, you know? They haven't found a cure.
But I always think about it as well. Like, I have a few friends who have never signed up to my Patreon, and a part of me is like, well, you know, maybe you just don't want to read my stuff. And then another part of me is slightly insulted. And like, one of my really close friends, I asked her once, and I was like, here, like, whoa, you know, why have you, what? Yeah, because because I obviously have no shame. But, you know, I was also interested, and I was like, I'm genuinely not saying this to be confrontational, but I just want to know why. And I was like, because I know that if I started a restaurant, she would be one of the first people in the door and insisting on paying for her meal. And that's actually what I said to her. I was like, I know if I opened a coffee shop, you would come in and support me. And not only would you come in and support me, but you wouldn't let me give you a freebie. Because what she said was that she felt weird giving me money.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, but you wouldn't feel weird giving me money if there was a tangible service that you were that you felt you were paying for. Whereas because people don't think that content, or whether it's comedy or whether it's writing or whether it's podcasting, we're very much in the mindset of getting all that for free.
Yeah.
Online.
Well, I think the reason why I wanted to support you on Patreon at first was because I liked you. I liked the things that you do. Like the finance diaries for me, I'm ashamed of money, so I didn't really read them. But I wanted I wanted to support you, because I wanted you to keep writing. That's why, as in like so I can see. I don't know. I can see that is scary. That whole like, is it tangible? And you're just constantly questioning what you do, as if like. It's just so yeah. weird to be in a job where you're like, is this worth something to someone?
Mm. Mm. Yeah. And I mean, it's really weird as well when you're depending on, because I used to kind of joke and go, well, I'm fucked if there's another recession.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But like, it didn't really occur to me that there was a pandemic around the corner, as I think it didn't occur to anyone. You know what I mean? So when this happened, it was really like, oh, that joke I made doesn't seem so funny anymore.
Why?
Uh-oh.
When it comes to understanding political issues, I am a self-confessed toddler. That's why I've enlisted the help of Steve, my politically savvy drinking buddy, to help me better understand politics.
Every couple of weeks, we get together and record on topics like what is the politics of language, what is Watergate, how the internet is killing democracy.
We take these big issues and we break them down into silly little comedic bite-sized bits. If you like the sound of that, then search for What Am Politics in your podcast app of choice, or find us here on the Headstuff Podcast Network.
We should talk maybe about the history of your career, because you kind of went from, like, I like what you're doing with Patreon now. I really like you, and I didn't like it when I felt that you were opening yourself up to bollocks that would be hurtful. So it's nice that you're behind a Patreon, and like, if people want to have a hate read or anything, they'll have to pay for the privilege, which is kind of cool.
I know that. That is really nice. Yeah, so like I started out as a journalist. I started out working in the Irish Times as a kind of freelance features journalist, and I was doing sub editing there. And then I kind of freelanced for a couple of years. I did some stuff for TV3. I did some TV styling stuff. Like a lot of stuff that you end up doing, I think, as an Irish journalist, because you kind of have to cobble a whole load of different things together to pay the bills, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Like, I think if I had been doing purely what I wanted to be doing, I would have just been writing features. But it was like, well, I'm going to try and get my name out there. And I used to just say yes to everything and do radio stuff. And then I started working at Stellar as deputy editor. So I was still working in journalism, but it was while I was working there that I started Snapchat. Snapchat got really big for me. I got a much bigger following. I started getting offered money to post about things on Instagram or to post about things on Snapchat. And I went, this seems grand.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to go fully like social influencer, and I'm going to make my living this way. And that's kind of how I got into, or how I became more of a personality, if that makes sense. And like kind of became better known in internet terms. And I did that for about 2 years. And then I just was like, I mean, probably similar to Patreon in a way, when you are only writing and posting and sharing about yourself, every compliment you get feels really personal, but so does every insult. So I found that really hard to cope with after a while. And like when I started, I think I was quite bullheaded and I was very thick skinned. And by the end of it, I was like, nobody could say anything to me. Like there was a period where I was practically afraid to leave my house because I felt like I would be walking down Grafton Street and 20 people would recognize me and also hate me. And I wouldn't even know that they knew me, if you know what I mean. But I was like, I could be walking around anywhere and someone could be like staring at me going, I fucking hate that bitch.
Right.
And I'd be just like obliviously going about my life. And like, I don't know why that bothered me so much, because it actually makes no difference to me if somebody's like passing me by in the street hating me. But it really got to me for a while.
I totally get you about that. Or like what I used to feel, I remember the height of me getting trolled was when like a really close relative, a really close relative had died, but I was getting trolled at the same time, but they didn't know that, like, you know, anyone had died or anything like that. So they were just calling me fat bitch of their own accord kind of thing. And I was thinking about it, and I was like, this is not even the worst thing that's happened to me today. Do you know?
Yeah.
And I can't, yeah. You're, and it kind of, it made me kind of put it all into perspective. But I do understand that feeling of, paranoia is the wrong word, because paranoia implies that you're wrong about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And statistically, yeah. If you feel that you're, if you, to say feel as well, but if you're getting negative comments, statistically, they have to be in Dunn stores or in Penny's while you're shopping.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's where they would be. Well, how do you feel about, because you've kind of, you're one of the only people that's kind of properly escaped that whole lifestyle. Like, do you still look at blogging now? Do you still pay attention to Irish blogging?
I mean, like, I don't pay attention to Irish blogging because I think, well, there's so few people actually blogging, but like, I still pay attention to the influencer world ish.
Yeah.
So like, I have people who I kind of became borderline obsessed with while I was an influencer. You know, they'd be like, why is that person popular? Why is that person getting this when I only got this? And I kind of check in on them.
Oh my gosh, the honesty.
Like, what are they doing now? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then there are some people that I just kind of forget about.
Mm-hmm.
And then after, like, you know, every couple of weeks, I go, I wonder what they're doing. But like, sometimes I look at, like, I look at someone like James Kavanagh, and I just think his life looks so exhausting. Like, having to be on all the time. And that was something that I really struggled with as well, because I suffer from depression and
yeah,
I can get quite low for long periods and I can get quite anxious. And like, if I had signed up to do a collaboration with some brand and they're like, okay, so I'm going to do 5 stories on Tuesday and I'm going to do a post and I'm going to talk, I'm going to, you know, like chat away about it throughout my day. And then I'd wake up on Tuesday feeling really, really low, not wanting to go on Instagram or not wanting to talk. But I would have, already signed up to do this collab, and I'd be getting paid for it, so I'd have this contract. And I'm like, fuck, because it's not like if you're depressed and you have to go into the office. You go into the office and you just like tap away at your computer all day, and like even if you get nothing done, you still get paid.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
When you're in an office job. Whereas for me, I was just like, fuck, like I have to do this, and then I would get so stressed out at this pressure for this thing that I'd signed up to do, and like, I think we have a long way to go in terms of understanding in any kind of workplace for stuff like that. Like if you go, I'm having a really low day.
Yeah.
Like I can't come into work today. I don't think that's something that most bosses are going to go, sure, no problem.
Well, that is a hard aspect of it, is your main selling point is you being nice. Like I find it weird. I don't find it weird, but there's a thing, if someone treats me, I remember someone tweeted me about something and said, Alison would never do this. And they were giving out to someone. And I was like, you don't know me. You don't know what I do. You can't presume that I would be like that. And also, does that mean if I did do that, that you wouldn't like me? Of course, everything is conditional. And it should be. But like, you become like very aware. And especially if you're like, it's not like I wanted to be known as a nice person or anything like that. But that's what I kept getting complimented for, was that I'm very nice. So then you kind of worry about your own behavior and you're like, am I behaving like this because someone has told me I'm nice, or am I actually nice?
And like, I think it's kind of like, you know, when you do something that's like performatively good.
Yes.
Like you see somebody dropping groceries and you pick them up and you have this moment where you think, did anybody see me being really nice? And then you're like, fuck, did I do that to be nice, or did I do that in case anybody saw me? I feel like when you have an online profile, your whole fucking life is like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You're like, am I talking about this on Instagram? Like, am I talking about Black Lives Matter because I genuinely think it's important and it genuinely resonates with me, a white person from Ireland who had like one person of color in my school? You know what I mean? Who like doesn't have any friends who are people of color, who doesn't have that much experience. Am I talking about this because it's important to me, or am I talking about it because I want to be seen to be talking about it?
Yeah.
And like, a lot of the time I think the answer is the latter. But like, I used to be really obsessed with writing back to people and always being nice, even if they were dicks, because I had this like paranoia that they would somehow tell someone who would tell someone who would tell my mom.
So,
do you know what I mean? Ireland is so small, like, that I'd be like, oh my god, like if I tell this person to fuck off, it's going to get back to my mom.
Well, so what would your mom get angry about? Like what?
My
have you ever made like, your mom angry in your public life?
Oh yeah. Well, she hates when I talk about anything to do with sex. She really doesn't. I mean, my mom and I have very differing views on the concept of privacy. I don't have a definition for privacy, and I don't have any concept of personal privacy, and she doesn't have any concept of personal oversharing.
Right.
You know what I mean? She's like, why would you talk about that? So she does get annoyed. Like, what does she get annoyed about? I wrote a piece on my Patreon a couple of weeks ago about poo, and just about how I'm really fascinated by like people's bowel functions.
Yeah.
And like, I'm always happy to hear about them. Do you know what I mean? That I'm like, if someone wants to talk about what's going on down there, I want to know. And my mom was like, I just couldn't get over it.
Really?
I don't understand why you would feel the need. But like, my mom as well is a very, she would never understand why you would say no to helping somebody if you could help them. So like, you could be sitting on your couch on a Saturday about to sit down and just relax and watch TV, and a friend will text you and go, hey, my car is broken down, will you bring me to the supermarket, right? And my mom would always be like, of course.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it would never occur to her, go, oh, I'm really sorry, I can't, and think like someone else will, or like their family will help them, or they'll get sorted, or it's not an emergency.
Yeah.
Like, she would just drive anyone anywhere. She would do anything for anyone. So I think the idea that like, if somebody, because people used to message me sometimes if I was like Instagramming about something I saw in Penny's, and they'd message me and they'd go, do they have that in a size 8? And you'd be like, I don't work there. Like, go in and look for yourself, you lazy bint. But like, if I said that to them,
yeah,
that's the kind of thing that my mom would be like, sure, you're in Penny's, would you not just look?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And so, but you, just to answer your mom, like, talking about shitting is great. Like, it brings a set of intimacy, I think, to any friendship or relationship, do you know?
And it's also a wonderful leveler.
It is. We all do.
Everyone
shit.
Does it.
Everyone shits.
Yeah, yeah.
Janelle Monáe shits, you know. Donald Trump.
I've never thought about Janelle Monáe shitting.
Now you have.
I sometimes like to imagine, you know, like when you see celebrities on the red carpet or the Golden Globes or the Oscars or something, I like to imagine them halfway through just really needing to go for a shit. Because like, there's something really comical to me about the idea of like all the makeup, all the jewels, the dress, the like $100 million Cartier necklace sitting on the loo.
Now I got images in my head of Lady Gaga in her big meat dress, just taking a big hulking shit wherever that was.
Oh, I don't know if she'd even be able to lift that up, though. I'd say she'd probably have to wear a nappy.
What, do people do that? Is that a thing? So you've covered...
I don't know.
I don't know. Some insider knowledge.
I did hear a story once about a supermodel who was doing a catwalk and had to get sewn into, you know, like one of these incredibly big gowns, and then announced she needed to go to the toilet, and they were like, no, like, you've just been sewn into a gown. So she peed in a wine glass.
Oh.
Which I actually just, like, I couldn't do.
No, definitely not. I'm thinking of like
go
a
everywhere.
Champagne flute, and that's not gonna
no
happen.
No, I mean, to be fair to her, I think it was a red wine glass, but I still couldn't
no,
do
no, that. No, me too. I was gonna show off. I can piss in a pint glass, though. I have done that before.
I honestly don't think I could. I think it'd have to be a bucket.
No, you could.
I have no aim.
I promise you, you can. You just hold it up very close. That is the.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like it's an egg.
Oh.
Now
I'm, I don't know why now I'm like, surely touching yourself with that wine glass wouldn't be hygienic. Why is that the issue for me?
Yeah.
Of like the hygiene of the wine glass touching you anyway.
There's so many issues. There's so many issues. And I'm glad. I'm glad we're covering them. So you've launched a new podcast. How are you? So you've just moved to America. When did you move? Just before the pandemic hit, wasn't it?
I moved. I flew on March 4th. I was supposed to fly on March 20th.
Right.
And then on March, I think about 12th, Trump announced the travel ban. And do you remember the initial travel ban didn't include Ireland, and then it did? But basically, when he announced the initial one with the Schengen zone and Ireland was excluded.
Yeah.
I went, fuck. So I changed my flight. And like, also, all the flights were slowly being cancelled, like, you know, all around the world. So I didn't actually change my flight. I booked another flight for basically the following day. So I was meant to be in Ireland for another week. And then I went, fuck, I'm just going to go tomorrow, which was fine, but a bit of a nightmare because I had, you know, you're like, I'm going to see this person. I'm going to see this person. I'm going to go for like one last coffee in this cafe that I love. And I'm going to go and do this and do that. And then I got to do none of that. But I left on the 14th. And then I think the day after I arrived, they shut down.
Wow.
All travel from Europe, I think. But like, I mean, you should have seen it was mayhem flying over because it was in such early days as well. I didn't have a, I didn't own a mask at that point. It didn't occur to me to wear a mask. Half the people on the plane were wearing the mask, wearing masks. Not even half, maybe 20%. And then there were a load of students there who had come from Italy, I think, via Dublin to go home, who had been sent home. And they were talking about how, like, this person on their course had been diagnosed with coronavirus and, like, somebody they studied with. And I was like, stop talking about it. And, like, they weren't wearing masks. They were just, like, all walking around the plane, standing next to people. Coughing. And I was just like, shut up. Yeah.
And so you came here and... did you have to quarantine? Like, what was the feeling in America when you first came?
Again, like, listen, America, even now, I've had so many people ask me, what do you think about this coronavirus? Think it's a real thing?
What?
And you're like, yeah. I didn't quarantine. In hindsight, I should have.
Yeah.
But again, at the time, it was so early that I was like, well, like, I didn't quarantine. So I went and I stayed in my sister's house, but we all social isolated from the minute that I arrived. So we all kind of quarantined together. But in hindsight, I should have just gone straight up to my room and stayed in my room for 2 weeks and, like, away from her and her husband and her kids.
Yeah.
But at the time we were like, oh, I'm probably fine. I'm young. We don't even know if young people are carriers. We don't, you know, we don't know. I mean, young, 35. I keep thinking I'm 18 and I'm like, reminder. So we just weren't really sure what was the right thing to do. So no, I didn't quarantine, but we came through Chicago. My boyfriend came and picked me up in Chicago, and there was a 6.5 hour wait from the minute the plane landed to get through customs, and they were checking temperatures and everything.
Whoa.
So there was a whole big long, but like, no social distancing,
right?
You know, this, like, just a queue of people on top of each other. Some of the people working in the kind of customs and passport place had masks. Some of them didn't. It was, you know, such early days, it was mayhem. Like, nobody really knew what to do. So there was temperature testing when we arrived. And I think if you had a temperature, I don't know what was going to happen actually if you did have a temperature, because I obviously didn't. I don't know if they were taking people away or if they were just saying you should quarantine or, I mean, I doubt they were detaining people. At least if they're American citizens, I'd say they weren't detaining people. But I don't really know what was happening. But yeah, then I came to Indiana and social isolated for pretty much 3 months, which is kind of like, I'm kind of still doing that. Like, I'll go to the shop wearing a mask, but I haven't seen anybody aside from my sister's family. And now I've moved to live with my boyfriend. So when I go and see my sister and her family, I'm staying 6 feet away from them and masked and stuff. So
what's it? All I can see of America from here is people complaining about wearing masks. Like, have you seen that where people refuse? So what's the attitude of the...
So masks aren't mandatory in 99.9% of places I've seen here. So there's one supermarket near us where masks are mandatory, and everywhere else you can pretty much wear one if you want or not wear one if you don't want. And where they are mandatory, like that supermarket where it's mandatory, I went in and I saw several people not wearing them.
Whoa.
You know, so it's just, yeah. So people are just doing whatever the fuck they want. A lot of people seem to think that it's a liberal hoax. A lot of people seem to think that it's being blown out of proportion. The man I met who asked me, what do you think of the coronavirus? Do you think it's a real thing? He was basically like, you know, maybe it is happening, but I just don't think it's worth shutting down the economy for. And I said to him, well, they shut down everything in New Zealand for whatever, 4 weeks, and they've been really, really strict, and they now have almost zero community spread. And he was like, God, I haven't heard that. I think a big problem is that America is so big that for a lot of people, they don't read any news outside of America.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when I told him as well, like, I know two people who've died from it. I know one person in Ireland who's been hospitalized with, and I know three people in Italy who were in intensive care for 2.5 months. And when I said that to him, he was like, people you know? And I was like, yeah, like, you know, people. And he was like, I don't know anybody. And that's the problem as well, that like a lot of people, because America's so big, it's so sprawling, you can only see and hang out and speak to your friend circle of 30 people from the same Midwestern town. And so you're not exposed to what's going on outside of that, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But like, also masks have become really politicized, like, thanks in no small part to Trump. So the idea that if you're wearing a mask, you're probably a liberal snowflake seems to be very prevalent. And there's a lot of like I went to Walmart today wearing a mask, and you kind of have to walk around with blinkers because whether or not it's in my head, you definitely do feel like you're getting some dirty looks from people.
Wow. Talking about Trump, the election's coming up in November. Like, do you think he's going to get a second term?
I don't know. Like, obviously, I haven't been here that long. I'm not super familiar with America. I think if coronavirus hadn't happened, he was probably going to be a shoo-in. I think because of what's been happening, the economy, and because of his response to COVID, his ratings seem to have slumped in the polls. But then the polls said Hillary was going to win. So I honestly just don't know. But like, my boyfriend's family, with whom I am friends on Facebook, a large proportion of them are Trump supporters.
Wow.
And are posting about how COVID is a hoax and the media is lying to us and it's a plandemic and, you know, share this before it gets deleted. Like, there's a big swathe of people who are very avid Republicans and very strong conspiracy theorists. And it's not, like, I think the perception when you're in Ireland is that it's just a small proportion of, like, very uneducated, very rural, very ignorant kind of backwater town Americans. Like, that's what you think, that you're like, Trumpers are people who live, like, in the middle of nowhere. Or, you know, kind of like that family. Did you watch Making a Murderer?
Yes,
on Netflix?
Yes, yes.
Do you remember his family? And they, like, when you saw how they lived, it was just such a, like, a demonstration of kind of extreme poverty in America. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, I think my idea of a Trump supporter was kind of that family. Not that I think, not that I know anything about that particular family's politics, but that I had this idea that people were like, it was very country people. It was very, you know, people who weren't very well educated, who weren't exposed to the news, who weren't exposed to people of different cultures or ethnicities or backgrounds. Whereas actually Trump supporters are everywhere.
Yeah. People did vote for him. So they do exist. It's strange how,
yeah, and
I think, like,
and people will vote for him again. Like, it's nuts.
Well, I think Trump supporters, there's a weird thing that the human mind does of kind of separating the humanity from a person. It goes for, like, predators and stuff. You kind of think a predator is someone that waits down an alleyway for someone, mm-hmm. and not like your boss or your uncle or you know, a film producer or something like that. And then we can't almost believe it because it's not what we had in our heads. So I'm just comparing Trump supporters to I don't mean it like that. I just, yeah, it's strange how the human mind works. So you're in America. Do you see yourself kind of maybe branching out into like American media? Would that be a possibility for you, or are you kind of done with that and happy to do the Patreon?
I'm working on a book at the moment and I'm doing my Patreon, and that's kind of where my focus is. I am doing a little bit of freelance work on the side, kind of more when I get approached. Like, I'm not really pursuing it, but like, if I get asked to do stuff, I'll do a bit of freelance stuff. I haven't approached any American media. Like, my sister's always on at me going, oh, you know, you should try and write a piece for this place, or you should, you know, pitch to the New York Times about being a kind of newly arrived immigrant. And I'm like, I just don't know if I want to kind of get my name out there in a way. Like, I'm finding it very, very relaxing being in America, where nobody knows who I am. And like, it's such a double-edged sword, because if nobody in the world knew who I was, I wouldn't have a Patreon following. I wouldn't be able to support myself. But on the other hand, it's just really nice to feel completely, like, this sounds, I'm hardly fucking Kim Kardashian in Ireland, but like, you know what I mean? That it's just really nice to just be like, I'm absolutely nobody, and I'm just kind of getting on my life and writing about what I want to write about and working away myself. And it's very, I'm probably more relaxed about my work than I have been in a long time.
Well, you seem like one of the only ones that is able to escape from, because I see people that do social media influencing, and sometimes I look at people and I'm like, you can't be happy doing what you're doing because it's so hostile. Like, it seems like you're one of the only ones that managed to actually pull the cord and escape from that. I feel like there's some people that I actually feel sorry for because this is the way they make their living, and it's a totally, like, when I say it's the way they make their living and I feel sorry for them, I think it's very valid and people deserve to be paid for that. Like, if you get, you're entertained, you know you're entertaining people, you should be paid for that. But when your job kind of relies on you opening yourself up to people that actively dislike you, it just seems hard, and you're one of the only ones that seem to have escape that. I commend you for it, but
I mean, look, I think it helps that I was never massive, you know what I mean? Like, I think if I had got to 200,000 followers and I was being given $3,000 to post an Instagram post about a jumper I liked, maybe I would never have been able, like, I don't know how easy it would have been to walk away from that.
Yeah no, totally.
Do you know what I mean? So it, like, in a way it was because I didn't get that big that I was able to take a step back and go, okay, I'm now going to do something else.
Well, maybe I should ask you, because I realise I have listeners in the UK and stuff, and I've been, because I like you, I want to chat to you like we know each other. It's very hard. I'm now very aware it's a podcast and people might not know, like, what I'm talking about. And just like the Irish scene, Ireland has a lot of influencers and we hold them to high esteem, I would say. Or I don't know. Is that because I lived in Ireland and I think that they're bigger than they actually are?
No, I mean, like, I think you can be the biggest influencer in Ireland and have 10% of the following that you would have in the UK or in the US.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's true. You know what I mean? Because Ireland is much smaller. I'm not sure if we hold them to really high esteem, but I think we hold them to very high standards sometimes in a way that I don't think is warranted.
Yeah.
Like, I think what's happened in Ireland is that we've kind of made famous social influencers out of very normal, average women. And I don't mean that disparagingly, but like women who, because we really like their personalities and we really like what they're sharing and we identify with their ups and their downs. And then we somehow also expect them to have, like, a fully working knowledge of law, to be, like, incredible writers. And so there are all these kind of really bitchy forums where people get really up in arms about, like, she hasn't written a good blog post in months, or she hasn't done this, or she hasn't done that. And you're like, but she's just, like, she didn't go to college for journalism. She didn't go and study, like, radio production or video production. She's making YouTube videos from her bedroom.
Mm.
And you're somehow expecting her to produce, like, TV quality content and also to have everything completely above board and to never make any mistakes.
Yeah.
And I think we are really quick to rush to judgment. But you know what? I do think that's a bit of an Irish thing, that, like, we love seeing someone do well and then we also love them being brought back down to earth.
That's very true. I think that's, like, I think why I'm fascinated with the whole Irish social media thing, it kind of feeds into that weird village mentality of, like, who should be shamed this week. So instead of, like, who's having an affair, it's who hasn't typed hashtag ad after a sponsored post or something. I was really into the Bloggers Unveiled thing and I didn't know who were talking about.
So was I. Hook it to my veins.
Yeah, I used to read it to my sister like a bedtime story. Like, it was like we were on holiday. And she didn't know and I didn't know who these people were referring to. We're like, oh, and they weren't wearing safety belts. It started, like, I couldn't give a shit now. That's mad.
I know, yeah.
Do you think that changed the landscape of social media influencers, Bloggers Unveiled?
No, but I think it changed the landscape of social influencer followers. I think it made followers really, it gave them a really, like, inflated sense of how important their opinions were, if that makes sense. That, like, you know, I think there's a real mentality of, like, well, I'm her follower, so I can tell her this. Kind of like the customer's always right, except in the case of bloggers, you're not the customer because you've never given them a single cent.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're like basically a blogger is a free magazine. You're picking up this free magazine and then going, I'm entitled to complain about what I saw in this free magazine. You're like, just don't pick up the free magazine.
Yeah.
Like,
do you
pick up a different one, or better yet, pay for a magazine?
Well, how is your do you listen to your patrons then a bit more than you would have listened to people that followed you on Snapchat because they're paying?
Not because they're paying, actually, but because they're not anonymous. Okay. But actually, since I left Snapchat, so like I listen to people on Instagram a lot more than I listen to people on Snapchat. Because on Snapchat, you could message somebody whatever you wanted. And because of the way Snapchat works, I couldn't then click into somebody's Snapchat profile. They didn't have a profile the way they do on Instagram. So I think on Instagram, because your own profile is more permanent, even if it's an anonymous one and you're called like Happy Hoppy House.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I can still click in. I can message you. There's somewhere for you to live on that platform. Like I can look at your home. Whereas on Snapchat, you can't do that. So I think on Snapchat, you'd get a lot more just random, snarky, anonymous commentary. Whereas on Instagram, you'll get more what I call feedback.
Yeah.
So I am more likely to listen to that. But you know what? My patrons, I'm always asking them, like, tell me what you'd like to hear, or like, tell me what you'd like me to write about. Let me know if you like this. Let me know if you don't like this. And they don't. Like, I get very little feedback through Patreon. Whereas I get much more, like, I think people, I mean, I don't know if people feel more entitled to give you feedback when they're not paying for it, weirdly, or if it's just that the people who are paying for it on Patreon actually like what I do, so are therefore less likely to criticize, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think maybe it's one or both. I think, do you know when people ask you, oh, please like this? So I look at YouTube and they'll go, please like and subscribe. And I'll subscribe, but your like feels almost like money, and it's not money, but it's like they've asked for it, so therefore you're giving it. It's been such a lovely talk today about about the weird mind. Yeah, I'm so happy that you agreed to come on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
No, no bother. Now, if people wanted to, like, because your Patreon's really good. You got, like, you got your financial diaries, and you got articles and just different bits and bobs. That it's like a little lifestyle magazine of Rosemary McCabe.
Of me. Yeah. yeah. Like, once a week, I write a piece on mental health as well. So I do, like, a midweek mental help post, and I do the money post on Mondays, and then there's a third article that can be anything on Friday. Like lately, a bit of it's been about moving to America, and like I've been writing about moving in with my boyfriend, and he has two kids, so I'm gonna start writing about the idea of being a stepmom.
Oh, have you seen the film Stepmom?
But it's like
lately?
Although I don't actually consider myself a stepmom, and if I did, I'd be like Julia Roberts' stepmom.
Yeah. But,
so yeah, kind of writing about those different adjustments.
No, that's cool. So you can go to your Patreon, and also you have a book as well. I should ask you about the book. So the book is coming out with Unbound, isn't that the name of the company? So how does that work? Talk me through that.
So Unbound is a publisher that essentially works by crowdfunding your book. So whereas with traditional publishing, they would agree to publish your book and give you an advance, and then, you know, rely on selling a certain number of copies to make that advance back. What Unbound does is you submit them a proposal and they say yes or no. And then if they say yes, you crowdfund to get the cost of publication covered, which means that you then get a bigger share of the profits once the publication is covered. But it also means that you can kind of pitch ideas that would be a little bit less marketable. So like, you know, a regular publisher isn't going to go for a book that they don't know is going to sell, mm-hmm. for example. Whereas with Unbound, you can go, you know what? I have this idea, like I'm really passionate about it, and I really think it's going to do well. And they'll go, okay, well, let's take a chance on it. And then if it gets crowdfunded, then it gets published. So the issue for me is that I launched my book about a month before before lockdown. I launched my book campaign. So we're still at like 35%, I think. So I am hoping that it will get funded. If it doesn't, like I'm writing it anyway. If it doesn't, I might self-publish it. I might just publish it as a series of chapters on my site,
yeah.
and then work on the next thing. But I am still hoping that that'll get published. So that's on unbound.com. And they actually have, like, they have loads of really interesting titles by authors you have and haven't heard of. And they also work a little bit like Patreon. So if you want to support someone's book, say if Alison Spittle's writing a book, right? And you want to support Alison's book, she might do a level that it's like for €50, you get a copy of the book, but you also get a 3-minute exclusive audio clip of Alison talking about a topic of your choice. Or you might get like a signed copy of your DVD or something. You know what I mean? So you can add little perks at different tiers. So like one of my tiers is you'll get a photograph of my dog to put in your book as a bookmark. Another tier is I will write a short story about the story of your love life, because my book is called This Is Not About You, and it's essentially about me and my experiences of dating and romance and kind of trying to find myself through the medium of men.
Through the medium of men! So,
yeah. So that's kind of why the love story comes in, that like at a certain level I'll write the short story of your romance as opposed to mine.
Oh, that's lovely. That's quite a nice thought. That's a thoughtful gift for someone if they wanted to get that.
Exactly.
And the podcast as well, that's available wherever you get podcasts.
Yes, not without my sister, with me and my sister Beatrice.
Jesus, you're making loads of content.
I am. Thank you, Alice. Yeah. I'm making loads of
content.
You're
like a factory. Very busy. A busy woman. Cool. Well, last question. I wonder if I asked. So we did a recording of a podcast at the start of the year before you left for America. And something fecked up and it didn't. I can't even remember what happened, but it didn't. I think I didn't save the recording or something. I don't know if I asked you this last time, but have you ever been to a Denny's?
No.
Oh my God. I've never been to a Denny's either, but I keep thinking they're very prevalent in America. Like,
I don't know that I've seen any Denny's here. Like, one of the most confusing things about America to me is that there's different things in different states.
Right.
So like where I am, one of the nice supermarkets is Kroger.
Kroger.
We don't have any Trader Joe's, for example.
I have heard it.
And we also don't have any Whole Foods.
What?
In Fort Wayne, yeah.
So what do you have?
We have Kroger and we have Walmart and Target. I have been to Cracker Barrel. I went to Cracker Barrel at Christmas. That was exciting.
What's that like?
You know what? I mean, weird, and it's full of like, it's like a typical American family restaurant. It's full of people, like full of kids, and everything comes with a side order of three things you don't want. You know what I mean? So it comes with like a huge side order of gravy and a huge side order of biscuits, which are essentially savory scones. I don't know why they call them biscuits.
Yes.
And a huge side order of like fried apples, although they were actually
fried apples. Is that a savory kind of joint, or are we talking?
Yeah, so like this came with, I think I got some chicken.
You're really selling
and
this
it came
to
with
me.
Like fried apples, biscuits and gravy. It was not, I mean, it was nice and the fried apples were nice. But what was amazing about Cracker Barrel is they had amazing Christmas decorations.
Okay. Are we talking?
I got a glittery, a glitter covered Holy Bible.
Whoa.
And I got a glitter covered Mary.
Oh my gosh, that sounds amazing.
They had loads of really, really good blasphemous Christmas decorations. Although they probably aren't considered blasphemous if you're doing it like seriously.
I know. I'm no longer a Catholic. Love the iconography. 'Tis very hard.
I love a glittery Jesus.
Yeah. Oh, you gotta have it. You gotta have it. There's something slightly camp about like Sacred Hearts and stuff, you know?
Oh yeah. I was actually thinking of getting a Sacred Heart from my house over here, like from a kind of an Irish, you know, just to keep the, but I never even have one at home, so I don't know why I actually want one.
I remember him from my grands and kind of seeing the red light, and it used to scare the shit out of me. I thought the devil.
They're very scary.
Yeah, I thought the devil lived in the red light and that Jesus was outside it. But that goes to show you my mind. Oh, it was so lovely chatting to you. Thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
You too. Thank you.
No bother. Okay. That was the Rosemary McCabe episode of the Alison Spittle Show. I am doing a tour of Ireland. I might as well tell you about it. September 3rd, I'm going to be in Dolan's Limerick. This will all be within the law. the 4th and 5th, maybe 5th of September. 4th anyway, definitely doing the Whale Theatre in Wicklow. And then I'm going to be doing the 2nd of October. I'm going to be in Waterford. And then on the 3rd of October, I'm going to be in Dundalk. And then I'm going to be in Debarra's. Oh my gosh. Well, I'm going to be in Whelan's on the 18th of November. That's a really important gig for me and I'd love for you to come. Because I miss stand-up comedy so much and it's actually driving me mad. This will all be within like all the safety, look, this is, these are proper venues and they take this seriously and they want to continue being open and working, and I want to continue working, but we don't want to hurt anybody and we're doing our best we can. God, I sound like I'm threatening someone there, but the 18th of November we're going to be in Whelan's in Dublin. And then on Thursday, the 19th of November, I'm going to be in DeBarra's Folk Club in Clonakilty. I can't wait. I hope, like, I'm looking at this with optimism and I'm excited. And I hope you can come too. It'd be really good if you came. And look, I'm going to be doing the 2 weeks quarantine each time. Even when I'm just, yeah, I'm going to be doing quarantine and then stuff. And I'll be sticking to the law. Because I live in London, so I am taking this seriously and I really want to do it. And I hope to see you there. This week's show has been brought to you by headstuff.org. Paddy and Alan, who are great. Sarah Garvey, who does all the production work. Thank you so much, Sarah. To Bobby Ahern from No Monster Club. He's got a new musical endeavour coming out called Sir Bobby Jukebox. You can buy his stuff on Bandcamp, and they have special days where 100% of the revenue goes straight to the artist, so look out for that. I think it's happening like once a month. William Conway did my artwork. I went to school with him and he's brilliant. Yeah, and I have another podcast called Wheel of Misfortune with Fern Brady, and you should listen to it on BBC Sounds, and listen to this podcast too because this is my original baby. But I mean, you're listening to it already. But I hope you have a lovely day. And yeah, best of luck. Bye.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.